Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And in this week's New Statesman podcast,
we review the election result. Yes, there's plenty still to talk about, particularly why Labour outperformed expectations and the Conservatives underperformed them.
We discuss postal votes and whether or not they could have tipped the election to Labour if they'd been sent off a little bit later.
And finally, we say hello to our new listeners because we've been hitting a pretty tight, endless podcast schedule, including our crazed 8am sleepless sing-a-thon. There are a lot more of you now listening to us. Do give us a review on iTunes if you so feel the need. So the dust has settled a little bit. Everybody has kind of calmed down, got their sleep back, had their porridge, I'm going to say. Come on, tell me you haven't been trying to eat more healthily.
I actually ate surprisingly healthily during the election. I think partly because, oh God, this is a terrible sentence, but I'm locked into it now. So usually during an election, my partner takes a lot of time off and goes to a marginal and I develop unhealthy living and sleeping habits because although I do the majority of the cooking, I realise I fundamentally only cook healthily for an audience. And so I start, you know, eating like pasta and pesto direct from the pan. And it just enters into this really grim stage. But because of the snap election, she'd used all of her leave, which meant then the deeply unhealthy election habits.
Oh, right. You weren't just kind of buying mozzarella fingers from the supermarket and sitting like and eating them on your sofa.
Yeah, like they did not happen.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's good. I'm pleased. You know, obviously, we should have a separate podcast about our diet and exercise tips for political journalists. But let's talk first of all about Labour and the kind of post-mortem of why they did better than expected, which has kind of, luckily, the conversation has kind of moved on, right? It's much more nuanced than it was about a week ago.
Well, I think, so we still don't have so YouGov has given us an idea. The local elections, which told us a great deal, it turned out, about what a Labour voter was, but not
How many of them there were
by any instinct, by any measure. And then, of course, the British Electoral Survey data will tell us a great deal more. So I think in terms of the what has happened, I was sitting down with lots of people from the leader's office for my column this week. And they were saying like they're very aware that there is some kind of problem with men and some kind of problem.
Tell me about it, Stephen.
And some kind of problem in the Midlands. But until we...
Tell me about it, Stephen.
We have some kind of broader idea of the full sort of picture of who these men in the Midlands were, they're kind of going, well, they're very deliberately not trying to work out what it is they needed to do better among that group of people until there's more data. And ditto, I think, it's slightly too early to work out. I mean, I think broadly the kind of over-the-shoulder, fairly obvious now, is... there was an appetite for a positive and radical message of social change.
Yeah, I also think it's quite easy to underestimate, because if you're in Labour, you want to attribute it to your own success, to underestimate how badly Theresa May cocked it up, particularly with the dementia tax and that manifesto and the way that the polls immediately tightened after that she just really, really repelled a lot of people. Rob Ford of the University of Manchester was doing some interesting tweets yesterday saying, you know, we talked about this youth surge, and actually there was this figure flying around of 72% youth turnout, which turns out to be wildly overestimated. I think the YouGov post-election poll puts it some more like 59%. So still up, a healthy bump, and therefore also kind of energising, because you think, well, there might be more to go, because actually that's lower than the referendum, I'm pretty sure. But actually the group 35 to 44 is kind of more important in terms. I think 30% of those people switched from Tory to Labour.
The more significant thing, and the slightly weird thing about this election, right, is that the collapse of UKIP and the collapse of the Greens in some ways, and the failure of the Lib Dems to surge in popular vote, although obviously had a very good night in terms of seat, means that in some ways the result, particularly on the Tory side, gives you a distorted impression of what happened. Because you'd look at that and you go, well, no one switched, there was just a surge. But actually, as you say, that decisively Corbyn had a more appealing message, slash the Conservatives were more
But she still
repellent.
Won handsomely among retired people. And actually, her vote share went up, what, 6 points? The Conservative vote share was up 6 points, but it's just that Labour vote share was up like 10 points.
Yeah, but again, it's sort of it's the churn effect, right? So there were an awful lot of Conservative 2015, Labour 2017.
And there was voter suppression, sort of accidental voter suppression, right? There are what I think Rob was calling the grumpy grannies, the people who you would have expected to turn out, and you'd expected to turn out and vote either Conservative or UKIP, and they just weren't there. They just went, well, I can't vote for Jeremy Corbyn, but I also now can't vote for Theresa May, so, you know, a plague on both your houses.
Yeah, Jeremy did a much better job, A, of getting people who hadn't voted for, who wanted to vote for him, to vote for him, but also, if you're a Labour voter with doubts about Labour, you voted Labour. If you're a Conservative voter with doubts about the Conservatives, you didn't vote. So
differential turnout for once helping Labour.
So that kind of seems to be some of the data. The interesting thing is, so again and again to my column this week, the running theme with people across the party is what does this mean for voter ID? Because
it takes a minute to explain what voter ID is.
So actually, I really mean Contact Creator, which is the data system that the Labour Party uses to
so
track
in every ward level,
voters.
Right, they have a list of every household and the people who are in that household, and over multiple elections, they build up a picture so they can say, you know, how you voted last time, how you voted this time, right?
Yeah,
and therefore that's quite useful in two senses, that you can go to places where people who are thought to be swing voters live. And you can also go to places that are definitely in the bag for your side just to do get out the vote stuff, offer people lifts to the polls, you know, give them a text on polling day.
Yeah, and you supplement it by buying data from supermarkets and the like, because obviously the advantage that the parties have over everyone else is they know a lot about who their voters are. So if, for example, you can spot a very strong correlation with the voters you have talked to. So this is a really bad example because this is not the kind of thing you need to buy. But let's say you know that you do very well with voters in the private rented sector, and you haven't been able to successfully knock on every door at everyone in your constituency in the private rented sector, but you know that 80% of the people you've spoken to in the private rented sector are voting for you, 10% are voting for the Lib Dems, and 10% are you know, voting for parties of the variegated left, right? Then what you do is you then just leaflet all of those people with the same message, because you know that broadly you are hitting more of your voters than you would miss, right? So on the whole, and in elections past, in the European referendum, you can mostly get a very good idea just by speaking to party organisers, trade union officials, what is going on. And that allows them to put their resources in the right place. Chris Cook was running a great series this election of basically tracking the Conservative visits.
Which is really funny because they went to all the wrong places, yeah. Right? But that's very good evidence to counter this emerging myth that actually there was stuff in the data that you could have read, you know, that the parties were kind of keeping it from us, where how badly they thought they were doing or how well they thought they were doing. Actually, the Conservatives polling internal polling does seem to have been whack as well.
Well, I think the really great thing about Chris's series is it has prevented Linton Crosby doing his usual thing after an election defeat of briefing, oh, I wasn't listened to. Because the interesting thing is in the Scottish campaign, they used Populus, who for various reasons were identified quite strongly with Remain and with the Cameroon, so were kind of frozen out in London. And in terms of where the Conservatives thought the battleground in Scotland was, they picked it almost perfectly.
Well, let's the other side of that is there have been whispers on the kind of, I guess everybody in Labour is a Corbynite now, but you know what I mean, the kind of pre-believers, about the fact that essentially Labour were, and actually some of the places do phrase it as, you know, Labour HQ sabotaged the election, but certainly that they got wrong where the battlegrounds were.
Well, I mean, they definitely did get wrong where the battle, Labour's, yeah, I'm going to use the word professional class, which is slightly imperfect, and I'm very open to benefiting. But basically, I mean, everyone who is paid to do politics, whether they are working for a trade union political team, working for the leader's office, working for an MP, working for a shadow cabinet, yeah. And then basically, Labour's professional class had this idea of where the battleground was. Resources were allocated based on...
And they thought it was a defensive election.
Yeah, and also not just they thought it was a defensive election, they thought they were defending quite deep. They thought then basically if you had a majority of under 8,000, you were probably gone, and then they needed to hold every seat with a majority of 8,000.
But that isn't necessarily analysis that Momentum and their big, you know, campaigning kind of army disagreed with, right? Because they also, their Find My Nearest Marginal app, as I understand it, had a lot of defensive seats.
It had a lot of defensive seats. Then actually, there were, so yeah, of the activists I talked to, and I will once again do my my shout out to any Labour Party members, you know, please let I'm always happy to come and you know, speak at a fundraiser or whatever, just so I can get an idea what how you feel about what's going on in your patch. And of the probably more than so after the defeat, as part of my sort of post mortem into kind of, so I obviously thought that there would be a surge, but I didn't think it would be geographically useful. And it turned out to be a very geographically useful search. So I kind of went through and went, oh, you know, well, and of, you know, the kind of more than 100 activists who told me how things were going privately. Although actually, I think one of the things that it did expose is I tend to, when an activist tweets at me going, great response on the hashtag Labour doorstep, I basically just bin it because
that's what they always say.
That's what they always say.
Yeah.
But actually, the thing I hadn't absorbed about the Corbyn surge is, if this makes any sense, a lot of the new members don't have what I think of as Labour member Twitter etiquette. So, I mean, now that they've joined and been very active, I think they've probably integrated into the sort of cultural weft of the general party. But the thing I realised looking back is some of those people were also going, oh, terrible response here. So it was a more useful...
They were actually telling the truth when they said
great. When they said great response. but in general, you just feel like, yeah, if you... Because I have had people go, yeah, in elections past, tweet, great response. You know, then texting or DMing being like, toxic response, the SNP thing is cutting through.
Yeah.
But of the 100 or so Labour activists I talked to, and actually the closer they were to their own data sources, probably about a third... Oh, yeah, roughly a third of them went, oh, actually... it's better than we think, we should move. So there were individual constituencies where local parties basically went, we don't care what region is saying, we're going to stay here and fight this campaign here. And there were very near misses where if the battleground had been in a different place, probably Labour would have done better. And for the Conservatives, if they had realised where the battleground actually was, so, you know, I'm trying to think of any particularly, Canterbury is a really good example, right? Lost by a tiny amount of vote. No visits, very little money, you know, no money other than the local budget and the regular mail shots. Probably, I mean, that's a really interesting example of how, because obviously one of the other things that this campaign showed is campaigns matter well.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to come in and say, is that campaigns, it's that when we're doing our kind of post-mortem about things we got wrong, one of the things that everybody relied on was the idea that polls tended to, if when they were wrong, they tended to be wrong in favour of Labour, which is, we now have quite a startling counterpoint to that. And the idea that actually you just, you know, the local elections preceding a general election gave you a really good idea of what the kind of final outcome would be. And I think one of the most interesting things that I've read, maybe because it just appealed to my prejudices, is Hugo Rifkin's piece in The Times about the fact that, you know, Corbyn's critics were right and he changed. And I think that's a kind of thing that is worth talking about. I mean, you've written about that before. His media appearances have improved enormously. And actually, I think I thought his first impressions had been made and they couldn't be undone. But actually what we think we saw was that those big high profile broadcast appearances were actually the first time where people had really seen him. And that really changed people's minds. They were like, oh, this guy chatting about jam. I like this guy.
So I partially disagree with the Corbyn's critics were right because he changed the thing. Because I think for me, it's, and there's the strong historical trend. Well, I kind of think looking back, then mostly the thing about campaigns not mattering is mostly they cancel each other out, right? So, for example, Labour very effectively at a local level, and then the NUT, who are not an affiliated trade union, but most affiliated trade unions, when you talk to them, will say, look, actually, we think the trade union who have the most biggest impact on this election were the NUT, with their posters that you may have seen against school cuts with the white and the, I'm slightly colourblind, so they might not actually be yellow, but the white and yellow stop the school cuts. Now, what the Conservatives tried to do with their school meals thing is by switching from giving everyone a free lunch to giving everyone a free breakfast, you save money because breakfasts are cheaper than lunch, and they were going to then use that money to undo the school cuts, right? Mm. So they correctly identified they have had a problem. Just like in the last election, the Conservatives correctly identified they had a big problem because Labour's childcare offer was better. And then Cameron basically went, yeah, we'll also have, you know, like Labour were offering 30 hours. We're like, we'll have 35 hours or some.
Yeah, but the problem was that they then offered a cheap-ass breakfast.
Yeah, so basically the problem, and this again is the whole campaigns do matter thing, right? Every other Labour campaign or Tory campaign, not just and you and I have covered, but basically through history, would have successfully gone, we will not do these school cuts, and they would have cauterised the issue. This Tory campaign weirdly ended up going down this rabbit hole of, oh, we're going to give you some money, but we're also going to cancel some lunches, and any school which has spent money building capacity to cook its lunches on site, you've actually wasted that money and you're not going to get it back.
But that's what I mean, is I think that, you know, the sort of battle for the narrative. And yeah, I think it's really important to talk about the things that Labour did that are a template for future campaigns. But it's also quite important to talk about the things that the Conservatives did that you should never, ever do, that are a terrible, terrible idea.
Yeah, and I think the fascinating, because the thing, you know, really early on, there was a, you know, poll by YouGov going, you know, who do you think's having the best campaign? And I quote tweeted at the time going, this is a really good example of people just fitting their beliefs about the leaders to fit the facts. Because although this was before the dementia tax, she was never having a good campaign, right? Labour were winning on the radio right from the beginning. You know, I said it at the time and I absolutely stand by it. Labour and Corbyn in particular were bossing the campaign, basically, not just from when the campaign was started, but from the Easter recess when they had that great set of policy announcements all the way through to election day. Labour were well on top. And so the fact that 44 to 21% of people were going, actually, Theresa May is having the best of this campaign, does show that you start with so much goodwill in terms of your first impression, you really have to nuke it. And I think the interesting thing is that if she hadn't, the other counterfactual is the leader's office knew they were fighting a good campaign, right? They knew they had popular policies. And the bulk of Corbyn sceptic MPs had decided they needed to be silent and be constructive. And they thought the campaign was going all right. But the media was very much not picking up on it. And voters were very much not picking up on the fact that Corbyn was having a better campaign. And it was then when they started...
Because I feel like a lot of people said... I mean, Matt Shorey broke ranks in the Times and said she's dreadful and robotic. And actually, the narrative in the last 2 weeks of the campaign was Labour have done really well here, Conservatives have done really badly, but it won't matter. And it was the final bit that people got wrong. But I don't think anybody outside of the Daily Mail ever try and say she had a good campaign? I mean, their dementia tax front page was hilarious, where it's like, finally a politician who dares to tell the truth. 2 days later, probably good U-turn on this, thanks.
But the Matt only really went, she's rubbish. He didn't go, the campaign is bad. Yeah, when I did my sort of, I think, like, look, Labour are having, or, you know, actually the unreported Labour are having a great campaign piece, which both...
super viral.
Both did very well among people who agreed with it and also got an awful lot of mockery traffic.
Yeah, but it got a lot of hope clicks. I mean, that's...
Turned out they weren't hope clicks, though, didn't it?
It turned out they were solid... you know, foresight clicks. But I think that's very true. Which brings me to the other thing I wanted to talk to you about, which I think is a really... We did an issue at the start of the year that we called The New Divides in British Politics, in which we talked about some of the different ways you could slice and dice up the electorate, city versus sort of ex-urban, old versus young, white versus ethnic minority. But the one that seems the most important to this election, I think, is age. And I think that's really fascinating. The only group... according to the YouGov that the Tories won is pensioners, and actually I think I wonder if I mean maybe this is my prejudice because I would like this to be the case, that housing has now become a sufficiently big issue that and a bulk of people are still trapped in the private rented sector, really unhappy about it. Far fewer people in social housing, far fewer people under 40 own their own home than they probably did 20 years ago, that this has now kind of made a big dent into the Conservatives.
So I think it's partly housing. I think it's bringing that. And again, I'm going to sort of caveat all of this with the fact that everything we can conclude, although YouGov had the best election and called the result with their model, you know, when the best data comes out, it will show us a more complex picture. But or it may just confirm it. But, you know, obviously these are all sort of interim observations. But actually, Labour won that demographic even in places where the average 30 to 40-something can get on the property ladder. So, for example, they won back Gower, where where young people who work in Swansea can still buy a house. Well, the big problem was
school
cuts. But
then I think that's schools, then, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the thing that's really interesting between the ages of kind of, I guess, 27 and 40. That is a group of people whose lives are quite insecure. Their time is incredibly stretched. Actually, public services are incredibly important to them. In the same way that public services are incredibly important if you're over 65, you're much more likely to be a user of the NHS, right? You're much more likely to be a school user, obviously, if you're at the age where most people in Britain have kids.
Well, this is the Leader's Office. So the Leader's Office know that they've got... Yeah, it's a great election result because it's tantalisingly close to power, right? But they also know that, well, they don't know, but they assume because you'd...
it's laughing still about funny. Theresa May.
It would be, I mean, yeah, it would be mad not to assume that the next Conservative campaign will be better than...
Yeah, I mean, even if you just reran the whole entire campaign again, but you didn't announce a dementia tax, I think that probably would have changed things.
But I also think the kind of interesting, because, yeah, the very long piece, and I sort of kept not finishing because I had a lot of thoughts about the Tory campaign's weird level of is then from a technical perspective, right, if you ignore the bits of the campaign that the candidate has to make decisions about, the Conservative campaign ran very well, which I know sounds really bizarre considering how obviously quite a lot of it
The social media strategy, although obviously Labour benefited from having things that were organically shareable, right, that people wanted to share. I saw, even, and I don't know why, you know, living in Lewisham and with my profile on Facebook, saw a lot of them. I saw a lot of Conservative adverts on Instagram. And this, I think, is very unpleasant. They targeted Diane Abbott mercilessly with, like, do you want these people organising, negotiating Brexit? And you were like, I think something's gone wrong if the Home Secretary is getting involved in this. But that stuff will undoubtedly have been quite effective.
Oh yeah, and they, in terms of what the other side were hearing and what everyone else's focus group telling them, yeah, they kind of, yeah, the sort of belt and braces, has their message been targeted? Were they mostly managing to beam it out to the right people? Yes, they mostly succeeded in all of that. The problem is their message was bad and did not have anything inspiring in it, and every decision the candidate had to sign off became a bad decision.
Do you think she should have done the debates? Do you think that would have actually changed anything, or would that have just exposed her?
No, so I always thought, yeah, I said at the start, I said after Battle for Number 10, and I think even more now, considering, because I kind of think, and seeing as my analysis all the way through was Jeremy will boss the campaign, but people
don't
change their minds.
Yeah.
Therefore, everything I thought he would do well in the campaign, I think that mattered more, not less. So seeing as my view on it was she was right to swerve the debates because he would beat her.
Yeah.
Feels to me likely. He's very good at that question time style format. She is not. However, the problem was, if you're going to swerve a debate, don't do it in a way which makes you look like a fraud, right? That whole I debate him every week, all that ridiculous moment where she
I'm going to go and talk to people individually. You were like, really? How long have you got?
Yeah, it's just like, you're not going to talk to people individually. Or when she said, he should be preparing to negotiate Brexit.
Oh, that
like
was
I
the
am.
Worst one.
It's just like, well, no, it's just like this. But I think this is... One of the really fascinating mistakes that political campaigns make a lot, and obviously it's not always true, CF Diane's truthful line about the IRA and Jeremy's fictitious line about the IRA.
So Diane saying, I've changed my mind like I've changed my hairstyle, versus Jeremy's, actually, I was a broker of peace, and that's why only met one side of the conflict.
I wasn't, and the thing is, like, most people... in the 80s, on the left, and I don't just mean the Labour left, I mean, you know, I'm including, you know, sort of like the quite right-wing bits of the left, did broadly have a more sympathetic, particularly in London, a more sympathetic attitude towards the IRA.
Yeah, and republicanism generally.
Than they perhaps should have given...
But that, again, is an age thing. This is what I think is really fascinating, is do you remember the time when Gerry Adams' voice had to be dubbed over on British television?
I used to think Sinn Féin was a person because of the weird dubbed voice. They all sound the same, right? Yeah.
Yeah, remember Tony Blair standing next to various people who had previously been in the IRA? This is what I think is fascinating, is that anyone, I would say, under the age of 40 really remembers the Northern Ireland peace process. They don't remember the Troubles as strongly, right?
But even
that fear message, therefore, sort of slightly fell flat with them.
But even among people who did mention the IRA, it actually lagged voting intention, so... I think it's partly an age effect, but basically the Conservatives got 60% of the elderly vote and 55% went, I don't like him because of the IRA. That, to my mind, looks like someone's gone, I don't want to vote Labour. I don't like him. Oh, something about the IRA. not I don't like him because of the, you know, as we've seen from the fact that there is an endless stream of, when I send out my free morning email, which you can subscribe to if you don't already, an endless stream of people going, will Sinn Féin take their seats, which just categorically won't happen.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, they just don't understand Northern Ireland.
People are in on the main island of the British Isles, as it were, don't care all that much about Northern Ireland.
How silly are we going to look when Sinn Féin do in fact take their seats?
Sinn Féin are not going to do an oath in which they swear allegiance to the Queen, not least because they are quite literally attacking another party in the Republic about doing this. I mean, the interesting what if, I mean, obviously at the moment it wouldn't matter because the numbers would still work for the Conservatives and DUP, but the interesting counterfactual is Owen Paterson, when he was Northern Ireland Secretary, briefly tried to change the oath so you didn't have to swear allegiance to the Queen.
Well, that's not ridiculous, because they already have a situation where you can affirm, right, rather than having to say anything about, I was going to say, Jesus, we can. But I've now tipped out. It's too long without sleep. Yeah, I think the only thing is, for lessons for Labour next time, I said this in my blog that I wrote about lessons this week, the thing that I think is a banana skin on the road is Brexit as a proxy for immigration and freedom of movement. And I think that's, if I was in the leader's office, that'd probably be maybe one of the top things that I would worry about your coalition of voters coming unstuck next time, because they definitely benefited from angry Remainers. They benefit from a lot of the kind of people in cities, younger people who will have friends who are EU nationals who, you know, are worried about what's going on. And I think their manifesto did say, you know, rights for anyone who's currently here on day one. But I think that as a freedom movement as a general issue, I think they've triangulated very successfully so far. I'd be really interested to know whether or not that can survive.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I have a question for a section I like to call
You Ask Us.
See, you mocked that and then you sang Les Mis, and people really like that on the podcast.
Yeah, but that was because
time.
It was an outpouring of joy.
Every week doing this podcast is an outpouring of joy, surely. The question this week is about postal votes, the timing of them. Did it affect the result? Because they went out and they had to be sent back in, I think, at peak May, am I right? No, at peak crunch time in the polls for actually Labour, things are tightening and Labour could have a chance.
Yeah, I mean, so the argument against postal votes, although it's made less because when postal votes were first introduced, the Conservative Party had an idea institutionally that they would largely be used by, you know, ethnics. And then this would help the Labour Party. They are used by, you know, ethnics, but they're also used by the old. So the Conservative Party has relaxed and learned to love the postal vote. And so people go, oh, what if things change? I mean, actually, in terms of, so the question we've basically been asked is, does the fact that the postal votes went off when they were and the postal votes were overwhelmingly bad for Labour mean that there's hope for Labour for a better result next time because those votes would have changed? Actually, in terms of, so the answer is for the Conservatives, it came right at the peak of the dementia tax U-turn. So it was actually probably the worst period of time for people to be sending their postal votes
off. Because you were saying
this
to me, weren't you? It's not just the dementia tax that hurt Theresa May, it's the U-turn on the dementia tax that hurt her.
Yeah, the really interesting thing from the because obviously post-election polls are much more accurate because they know what they're waiting to. And the focus groups, which again, tell us the general mood. And just also from, you know, knocking on doors and speaking to people about it and speaking to activists about what they've heard, which obviously, yes, was imperfect in some ways, but, you know, it's still better than me just plucking things from the ether. The U-turn actually seems to have broken through more than the original policy, because her promise, of course, was that she was strong, stable, and wouldn't do anything crazy. And then she U-turned on the election, she U-turned on the pension, and people suddenly like, oh, it kind of seems like you change your mind all the time. And the other thing which is interesting is the other thing which annoyed voters about her is this habit, which, again, weirdly, obviously, journalists... I think it's an interesting example of how if you cover politics, you kind of forget something is annoying. Because for ages, journalists were going, oh, but she's giving another speech in which she acts as if she only became prime minister. You know,
She's never been in the Conservative Party before. Yeah.
But we'd kind of been inured to it over the course of a year. But for a lot of people who kind of were just switching on to politics for the election campaign, the enough is enough speech, for example, people just like, but if enough is enough, isn't...
Why are you even here,
yeah,
bro?
Yeah, isn't this your job? Why are you telling us that you've failed?
But this is more vindication for your music, 5 minutes of music journalism theory of politics, right? Which is what you need to recapture is the sense of what it's like to meet and encounter people for the first time and kind of strip away. Because that's, I think, that's why people misjudged Jeremy Corbyn, right? Because they remembered all the things that, you know, and actually his positions 2 years ago, you know, when he was talking about NATO being a kind of thing that should be, was completely obsolete and outdated. That was a thing that kind of people went, oh, that's a bit much, isn't it? And but that's all gone. So for people who met him for the first time, he just didn't have that anymore.
And I think things like...
You've got to recapture that freshness.
I think one of the things that the leader's office thinks, and I think they're correct to do so, is that things like his one show appearance where he was calm and affable.
I love that one show appearance. Just, I mean, it was quite boring, but in a very, very reassuring way.
Just meant that the idea that this genial man on the one show was a scary threat just didn't work. He just wasn't plausible to people.
His image, I think, when it did a really interesting thing. I'm trying to work out exactly how to encapsulate it, but this sort of kind of underdog thing of the difference between, I think, because he had nowhere to fall, right? Because he'd accepted that to some people he was ridiculous and was just kind of brazing through it. It actually meant that when he did things that were kind of a bit, you know, people could laugh at, actually people had he'd got into, weirdly, from the other side, into that Boris Johnson pass the gaff into the he's doing it deliberately, it's part of the persona thing, right? Whereas now you see Theresa May, who was this big, you know, ice queen monolith. Now, whenever she does slightly wrong, it kind of, she looks ridiculous, and she's got further to fall, if you see what I mean. Where he didn't have anywhere to fall. So they just kind of bounced off him.
Yeah, and I think they also did, no, actually, I think that's wrong, to be honest, because, so I did a Newsnight documentary, which you can watch on the YouTube, and Seamus had, for a long time,
Seamus Milne had been
trying to smarten him up and, you know, sharpen up his suit. And actually, from doing not just archive footage from the last 2 years, but from the 90s and 80s, like, he does look like a very sort of together, yes, kind of scruffy in a homespun way, but he's gone from being scruffy in the kind of way of, like, the weird alcohol my mum makes at home kind of way, and scruffy in a kind of craft beer kind of something you'd happily buy in a bar kind of way. Now, so yes, technically those two things are the same, but one of them has a, you know, so he...
One of them's like, this is my personality, but I'm competent.
Yeah.
And one of them's like, I slept in a hedge, right? And that's what's
kind
of...
Oh, so she sent you some of it as well.
and I think those are the sort of difficult. But the other thing he really did do completely successfully is communicate his personality and what the things were that people had liked about him in the first leadership election, right? And actually the fact, I think you and I were talking about this ages ago, there's that he and this Kendall actually got on quite well together during that course of that election, because they were just kind of people who just would sort of chat and had warmth together.
Yeah, and I think the warmth obviously helped. But yeah, in terms of the postal vote question, the place where I think it almost certainly made a huge difference was Scotland, because the postal vote sign-off and arrival time, and mostly people send it the day that it arrives or the day after, was the SNP had to cancel their manifesto launch because of the Manchester attacks, which meant some people will have voted presumably without the SNP getting their sort of big day in the sun and a large chunk of their coverage. Obviously, it was a astonishingly bad election result for the SNP.
Well, that's another question which I have for us, is maybe for one for a separate you ask us, but about how much credit we should give to Carwyn Jones in Wales and how much credit we should give to Kezia Dugdale in Scotland. Because actually those were two regions that Labour had been, at the start of the campaign, really predicted to struggle in, and it's two regions where they did really well. And I think, again, this is about the kind of power of narrative. Obviously, not to take anything away from Jeremy Corbyn, but there were lots of people who, you know, John Woodcock explicitly ran against against him and kind of picked up votes. There were other people who definitely, I know, did work about, don't worry, even though you don't like Jeremy Corbyn, you can still vote for me. And they had to work kind of, you know, to, it wasn't a vote for Jeremy Corbyn, it was a vote of in spite of him. And I think that's, we just have no idea how big that vote is. And we kind of have no idea how big a vote there was for Carwyn Jones's Labour.
Well, I think the interesting question, particularly in, so because in, you know, in John Woodcock's seat, that it's not a young constituency, there wasn't a young surge, and there wasn't even that much of that 30 to 44 session. But my instinct is Ed was already quite iffy on whether or not they were going to keep the subs. I kind of feel that if you care about that, someone being quite iffy probably means your vote has gone, right? Mm. Someone being really not into it at all, well, you're already alarmed. So maybe they're just...
But someone who likes jobs generally and likes trade unions generally and that kind of stuff, I think in a way some of that sort of slightly offset it. Because he did have a slightly mad line about we were going to make the subs anyway, we were just going to kind of race them around the channel.
Yeah, I think... I also think people do kind of, I'm yeah, as people know, I'm a big skeptic of the utility and in the size of personal votes. Simon Danchuk ran on
Danchuk
his own.
Brutally found out with his 881.
But the thing is, actually, that's quite a, if you think about the size of a constituency, that's not a bad percentage in terms of your
the number of people you can meet, particularly if you're Simon Danchuk.
Yeah, right. But it does kind of show the lack of utility of personal votes. I think in terms of the Wales issue, so obviously Carwyn is popular. And he is an electoral asset to them. So it probably did help that he was a big presence on the campaign trail. However, all of the evidence... So last time, right, 2015, very bad election in Wales, where, again, they knew that they had an Ed problem, so they put Carwyn front and centre. They lost seats. It was not a great night for them. Welsh election 2016, great night. I think people understand that they're not voting in an election in which Carwyn Jones is going to become Prime Minister. Mm. I think it may have sort of allowed some people who didn't like... because obviously what you kind of want in any election is to maximise the number of people who don't like your leader but like your party, the number of people who like your leader but don't like your party, and get them to hang together, right? So he probably gave some of those people an excuse. I think in Scotland, we'll see, but my instinct is actually... The National Labour Party standing in Scotland, I think, did a better job of being more attractive to voters than the Scottish Labour Party at Holyrood. Not least because you can argue about whether or not baby boxes are the best use of sort of public funds, but I think there has been slightly too much oppositionalism to broadly social democratic-ish things than the SNP has done in the Scottish Parliament, which was absent for obvious reasons from a
national I guess again
campaign.
You've got the 2016 Holyrood election results to kind of compare with the performance at the general election, and they significantly outperformed.
And I think
that
one of the things which sort of stuffed them, and I think this again is something that Jeremy did very well that Ed did not do, is they very early had their no pacts, no deals. Emily Thornberry had her "We'll bring a Queen speech, and if the SNP want to vote us down and explain to their electorate why they've let the Tories in, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough."
I think Emily Thornberry had a great election. I know she got her boob pie-fied by Jeremy Corbyn, but my secret fave for Emily Thornberry was entirely vindicated by that absolute kippering that she gave to Michael Fallon on the Marshall sofa.
I think, in my top five election moments, I think that's number two.
And what were you doing on the 13th of June 1995, whenever it was? Oh, it's great.
It was
anyway, I can't talk about my love of Emily Thornberry forever, Stephen, so we'll have to end there. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, hosted by me, Helen Lewis, and my co-presenter, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Burke and mixed by James Shield. You can do one of many exciting things. You could subscribe to the magazine, thus allowing Stephen to buy more of the suits, which I see from his Instagram he wears even on holiday. And you could also come and see us live at the King's Place Politics Festival on the 25th of June, that's next Sunday at 4 p.m. Just search for New Statesman Podcast Live, King's Place.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.